White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is White Aryan Resistance. This is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy, in the bunker right here in north central Indiana, where we have a beginnings of a little rainstorm coming in here. It's cooling off. Started out about 50 degrees, now it's dropping. All that stuff coming down from Alaska is going to catch us, man. Hey, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. We're also at resist.com for our giant website, where you can download literally hundreds of radio shows free and books and all kinds of things from that website. But you send your donations to P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And any snail mail will go to that box. And if you have prisoner mail that you want me to send from here, and you don't mind me reading what you're sending, I'll send it on to you. But I won't send it on without reading it, because I don't want to get the inmates in more trouble than they're already in. Now, before I went on the hunt this last week, I did send out five $25 money orders to inmates. I think I told you that before I left. And we sent out two or three books, too. So we took care of that before we went on the prowl, praying, P-R-E-Y-I-N-G. Well, I was out on the coast for a while there, about 4 days, 3 days plus. And it's not getting any whiter out there. It's getting browner and browner. And one thing I noticed, that the browners got more money than they used to have, because you can go to an upscale, fairly upscale theater and start seeing the brown people coming in there in a lot better cars and a lot better clothes and a whole bit. So what goes up, goes up. What goes down, and what so whitey's going down and brownie's going up. Well, I see our friend Obama, loosely speaking, has decided to let more chink, chink, chinks in. And he's going to let them in and lower the trade barriers and get rid of the tariffs. No tariffs, no problem. And the chinks will be able to come in on a 10-year green card, a 10-year access to the United States. Plus, if they've got enough money, they can buy themselves a citizenship at $10,000 or so. Yeah, so there you go. That's our State Department. If there's one area of our government that needs to be eliminated and reconstructed in a white way, it is the State Department. A lot of you people don't pay attention to that, but most of the bad shit coming out of Washington comes out of the U.S. State Department, whether it has to do with now they're going to bring even more Iraqis over here, because as we destroy countries, people run away and try to go someplace where they can survive. I don't blame them in a way, but it makes the United States the dumping ground of the world. And so I noticed at the airport, and I think it was Detroit, I was hearing a whole lot of Chinese on the loudspeakers up there. So whenever you get that, get to that point, that means there's a lot of them there, and a lot of them are planning not to go home. I had an email from an East Asian today wanting to know my position on East Asia, and compared to the blacks and all this kind of stuff. I said, well, we don't really care what country the non-white comes from. He's going to eventually need to leave this country, or if the white race decides to commit suicide, he'll end up taking it over, because East Asians and Chinese and other Asians are a lot smarter, and they can handle the Jews too. I've seen them do it. And so anyhow, we got all kinds of good news, baby. Except you hear my tick-tocking at the front of the show. Whitey's out there. Lone wolves, I hear them crying. I hear on the media crying about they're the lone wolves. We never know what they're going to do. It's easy to infiltrate all these right-wing groups, and they're all infiltrated up to the ears, and people are putting crap on there to throw people off. But they can't do it to the lone wolves, because the lone wolf's in charge of his own destiny, and he has a collective mind. He just doesn't physically collect. You get that? You know, it's called the mass mind. And you can read about it in psychology. If enough people think the same way or think close to the same way, they become a mass mind. And they don't have to get together. They don't have to have meetings to know what the plan is. And we know there's only one plan eventually, and it'll come about. Yeah. Well, I'm sorry I had to get this news from an inmate, but I'm glad the inmate at least was on his toes. Our good friend from the 80s, Bud Cutler, has passed away. He lived up in Wyoming on a ranch. I'm going to read to you what David Tate said about Bud Cutler. Interesting that you might find interesting that when Bud Cutler was released from federal prison, John and Tom Metzger were there to greet him, took him out for a big dinner, and we got renewed acquaintances. Bud Cutler was born on August the 19th, 1925. He died September the 6th. It took that long for me to get the information. That does not make me happy. Bud Cutler is a name many of the old, from the old days of the original Church of Jesus Christ Christian Aryan Nations will remember. At the noble age of 89, he passed away. And his wife, Helen, preceded him. Even in his advanced age, Bud remained healthy, active, and clear of mind until cancer took him over a few short months. When I think of those who I consider men of the old guard, Bud Cutler comes to mind. I remember Bud not just with admiration, but esteem. Bud worked with Richard Butler when he first established the Church of Jesus Christ Christian in North Idaho. He was among those who helped in the converting of the old farm buildings into the original chapel and office, and over the following years in adding wings and outbuildings to the reconstruction after the main church building was bombed in 1980. Of course, they never found anybody who did the bombing. And, of course, if the shoe was on the other foot, they'd have found one of our people in 5 seconds. Afterwards, many will remember Bud as the head of security in the old church until he was set up and railroaded to prison in the late 80s. I was just 16 when my family joined the church in 1978. And in my youthful mind, Bud was a figure to look up to. Loggers their entire lives, Bud and his younger partner Larry had the physique of bodybuilders without having so much as touched a barbell. Bud was not a self-assuming man, reserved and ever honest. He was from an age when men were measured by their actions, and he never postured or bragged. He was a working man who raised 2 sons and 2 daughters, and a mountain man before Hollywood made them up on film. Bud personally knew all the key members of the order, and I can now admit that he was one of our unsung members. He took his oath seriously, and this led to his falling victim to the federal dog posing as a white man. This race traitor pretended to be a kinsman for several years before he claimed to be in touch with a mercenary who knew how to find the infamous traitor in room 14, Thomas Martinez, and was only looking to cover expenses. He first attempted to reel in Pastor Butler and then my father, Charles Tate, and when neither would bite, he turned to Bud, who had actually been his friend for several years. See, there you go. You got to understand this. People can go bad on you, and you may know them for years and think they're 100%. And that's why staying lone wolf is so important. Feeling honor-bound, Bud put up the cash and was sold a mock photo of the decapitated Martinez. For this heinous crime, he was sentenced to 12 years. He spent the first 7 in prison and the rest on parole, where he was barred from contact with anyone among the folk or even returning to Idaho. He lived on a ranch in Wyoming until many years later, when he moved back to Post Falls, Idaho, where he lived until his passing. Incidentally, my grandfather, Linton, my blood grandfather, built the hotel there. I believe it was Post Falls, one of those towns there. After his passing, Bud's body was laid to rest in Wyoming next to that of his dear wife, Helen, who many of us also remember with fondness. As a sincere patriot, racial patriot, Bud would appreciate our shared knowledge that when the children of God and nature on the dust returns to the earth as it was, the spirit returns to nature and nature's God who gave it. Farewell, brother of our folk. You have lived as an honorable son of father, and so I will look forward to greeting you again in the mountains. David Tate, on the back here, as a member of the order, I can say we made every mistake in the book. I'm sure that Bud would forgive me for using this example to remind coming generations to be safe drivers. Always stay in your lane or the revolutionary highway. If you are part of a legal and lawful above-ground organization, you do not involve yourself in any illegal or criminal activity, no matter how well intentioned. If you plan to do such things, then you get away and stay away from all movements. An involved law-abiding kindred in your activities is betrayal. Plain and simple. The only things found in the middle of the highway are yellow streaks, dead skunks, rats, liars, informants, mental retards, and undercover feds. The federal police above ground groups, because they can't get any leads on imaginary revolutionaries hiding in the metaphorical bushes. The establishment has turned every pro-white movement, no matter how law-abiding, small or innocuous, into a racist boogeyman in order to justify their suppression of the natural response of white people to reject the systematic subjugation and murder of our kind. As a result of their paid mercenaries and the legal machine that directs them, need to justify their paychecks, and they do this by stomping out any serious white resistance to genocide that is race mixing. I don't care how clean you think your group is, if you are pro-white and vocal, you will be investigated. Live and act as if you are being watched, because you are. There is no need to live in fear and paranoia, but everyone should be cautious and vigilant. Break no laws and allow no one else to involved in your circle to put you at risk because he or she refuses to take the same common sense precautions. Well, the time will come when other methods will have to be used. But as far as I can see, this is not exactly the time. It seems like it should be, but I don't think there's any particular act you could perform that would begin to solve the plight of the race today. The time is coming, but it's not here yet. So I thank Order Member David Tate for sending that to me. Bud was a hell of a nice guy. I knew him briefly, but and like I say, when he got out of prison, we were there to meet him and greet him and celebrate with him. Well, I want to thank, I got a thank you from Matt Hale's mother, of which I do every time I send a donation that comes from you. And thank you for your donations to Matt's Defense Fund. We really appreciate your help. You can write Matt at the following address, Matthew F. Hale, 15177424, USP Florence ADMAX, P.O. Box 8500, Florence, Colorado, 81226. And you can send him donations to Matthew F. Hale, 15177424, P.O. Box 474701, Des Moines, Iowa, 50947-00001. Make that a federal money order, U.S. money order. And you can send donations to Matt's mother, Evelyn Hutchison, Hutchison, 200 Carlson Avenue, apartment 25H, Washington, Illinois, 61571. Now, I think everyone with the sound of my voice, and especially relatively new people, should read Nature's Eternal Religion and The White Man's Bible from the Creativity People. And you can order these. That's a good price, $10, from Reverend Rudy Stanko, Stanko, the Creativity Bookstore, Rural Route 1, Box 171, Gordon, Nebraska, 69343. And tell them Matt Hale sent you. Those are at least valued $20 books. They're valued more than that for what's in them. But I think that if you went around trying to buy them anyplace else, they'd be at least $20. And you should, every one of you should read those two books. Because that's where things started separating from the right wing to a more pure racial struggle with non-religion or non-Christianity and not arguing over all that stuff, Christ insanity. One thing you should understand that it's best to send a book to an inmate through a book publisher. It makes it a lot easier. Now, on books that are hardcover, you simply have the book distributor send it directly to the prisoner, the inmate, but tell them it's an inmate and they need to tear the covers off a hardcover book. They won't let a hardcover book in for obvious reasons. Paperback, you don't have to say anything about that. They'll send them right on in. I've had no trouble at all. If I can get the book from a publisher, I get a lot of them from Abe Books, A-B-E Books, but Amazon's got them, eBay's got them. You've got to shop around to get the best deal. So when they tell you that they don't let hardbound books in, what they don't tell you, at least no prison's told me, that if you tear the covers, the hardbound covers off, they'll go right on in. And the publishers and the bookstores will do that for you because there's a lot of books go into prisoners. I never realized until I started talking to some bookstores of how many books they send into prisoners, and that's good. A little historical point. They're always raving on about how this was a Mongol-populated country all over the country. Well, it was a little bit, but in reality, there were only roughly 500,000 Mongol Indians in the whole of North America. Well, I'm back, boys and girls. I took a little break there. How about that? Took a little break for the Veterans Day deal. I went down and got me a free lunch. Yeah, chicken, mashed potatoes, gravy, everything. Yeah. They asked me what branch I was in. I said, Panzer Division. They looked at me like their eyes got big. These were the women serving the food. I said, no, not really. I was Army Signal Corps. However, to be perfectly honest, if I would have been of age at the time of the Second World War, early on, I might have just slipped over there and fought on the side of the Germans. Yeah. Bob Miles fought on the side of the Free French. A lot of guys are going over and fighting on both sides. The next best thing I could have done, and which I did, was volunteer to go fight in the Hungarian Revolution against the dreaded communists back in 1956. But they weren't taking anybody to help the Hungarians out. Well, let's get back into David McCollum's great work, Exiles from History, about you-know-who. And I think I know where I ended up last time. I hope I'm not going to be doing it twice. I put a mark in the book here. Anyhow, Jung to Freud, 28 October 1907. Freud replied patronizingly on 15 November 1907, I shall do my best to show that I am unfit to be an object of worship, unquote. But privately, Freud predicted that Jung's idolizing of him would end in rebellion. Sure enough, when Jung went alone on a speaking tour to America in 1912, he criticized some of Freud's fundamental ideas. Freud interpreted this independence as a resistance to the unconscious mind and a wish to destroy the father image. When Jung returned to Europe, Freud tried to patch things up but ended up in a faint. Matters only grew worse, and Freud began to accuse Jung of encouraging all the splits in the movement. Freud's new book, Totem and Taboo, in 1913, only exacerbated their difference. In this work, Freud argued that sexual customs were based on primitive society's behavior patterns and not on biological instinct. Where the primitive patterns came from, he didn't say. His therapy practice developed over these years, and he gradually evolved different rules of approach. He determined that neurosis could only be cured by encouraging its transference into something more immediate. The treatment of the second neurosis would automatically bring about the cure of the underlying neurosis. The only exceptions, he said, were those neuroses which are narcissistic and therefore psychotic and untreatable, you know, like George Bush Jr. Even severe depression is narcissistic, he argued, because it's a form of hatred against others which becomes misdirected against oneself on account of the social taboo on open displays of hatred against loved ones. Eventually, Freud concluded that the aim of all his life is death, an aim to arrive at a condition that is totally devoid of all tensions, stresses, or strains. It was around this time that two of his daughters died, and he himself suffered a severe operation of the jaw, resulting in his upper palate being artificially replaced. Shortly afterwards, the National Socialist regime took over in Germany, 1933, and in Austria, 1938. Freud's books were declared heretical and were publicly burned. The Freud family immigrated to London, where Freud died a few days after World War II broke out. With more than 40 years between Freud's death and the present, at last there are signs that his erstwhile infallible status is being challenged. No longer are his theories accepted without challenge, and some bolder psychoanalysts are now actually turning the tables and applying analysis to Freud's own life and career. According to Dr. Harold M. Voth, a psychiatrist at the Menninger Foundation and himself a Freudian analyst, quote, I think that Sigmund Freud had sexual conflicts within himself which he did not resolve. His belief in constitutionality bisexuality, for example, was an excuse for certain personal traits I believe analysts are brilliant and dedicated people, but analysts tend to attract those with a personality similar to Freud's, passive men and aggressive women. The widely published author Martin L. Gross writes, Dr. Voth is convinced that Freud displayed a considerable degree of femininity in his personality, a trait that has colored the entire profession by making what he calls the neurotically troubled Dr. Freud a model. Those driving needs have infiltrated the psyche of millions of individuals as well, remaking much of our own personalities in his image. By offering his catalog of foibles as the symbols of normality, Freud achieved immortality. He has successfully projected his personality and his style of thought onto much of humanity, especially the impressionable American psyche. So you see some of the basis for a lot of the goofy stuff that goes on now. It's still from Freud. We have all, some wittingly, others unwittingly, become the children of Sigmund Freud. Although the impact of Freud's personality has been broad, it has not generally been beneficent. The portrait that emerges is one of a man driven by the furies of hostility and envy, weighed down by depression, death wishes, phobias, and severe debilitating neurosis. He was professionally distorted by his extreme superstitiousness and gullibility, the antithesis of a man of science. Freud, the man, is more the unhappy philosopher than the intrepid researcher who society thought would unlock the key to our confused behavior. The failure of psychotherapy is now obvious. What is less apparent is how closely that failure is tied to the personal shortcomings of the prophet himself. As a theoretician and scientist, Sigmund Freud was impulsive. His work was tainted by an unmistakable style of excessive enthusiasm, when often led to inaccuracy. He was an adroit, even brilliant theory maker, but his wish to have something true overrode all the objections. Freud was a self-confessed, impetuous thinker, a conquistador of the mind, he called himself. The result was that both his career and his disciplines of psychotherapy and psychoanalysis, which he spawned, are lavishly strewn with errors, which Freud presented the world with absolute confidence, even arrogance. Sounds a bit Jewish. In a candid and insightful chapter, The Shadow of Dr. Freud, Dr. Gross goes on to show how Freud's theories were all extrapolations of his own personal hang-ups. Oedipal love triangle is a prime example of how Freud's personality has distorted psychology and psychiatry. During his self-analysis, Freud learned that he felt passion for his mother and jealousy against his father. As an adult, he had a recurring thought in which he visualized his beautiful and slim mother, Emily, judging from his belief in the trauma of primal seeing one parent during intercourse. Freud, as a boy, must have watched his attractive mother have sex. What might have been overlooked by a less driven child seemed to dominate Freud. Freud obviously experienced oedipal lust, a disturbance which non-Freudians such as child psychiatrist Dr. Stella Chess of New York University believes affects only a small number of children. He then suffered the delusion that his abnormality was normal and universal. Freud's relationship with his mother was a long and satisfying one, the quintessence of the heralded Jewish mother-son love. She lived to be 95, dying when Freud was 74. Freud hinted repeatedly of the power of her love, stating more than once that if a man has been his mother's undisputed darling, he retains throughout his life the triumphant feeling, the confidence in success, which seldom brings actual success with it. Freud was Amelie's favorite. "My golden Siggy," she called him. The only thing that brings a mother undiluted satisfaction is her relationship to her son. It is quite the most complete relationship between human beings, he wrote. Freud added a metaphysical sex idea. For the mother, he said, the little boy brings the longed-for penis with him. Freud exhibited latent homosexual characteristics, as he himself admitted to his intimate friend, Dr. Wilhelm Fleiss. Do you think that's got anything to do with the tremendous amount of homosexuals now, through Freud's work? And when Freud's biographer, Ernst Jones, first met him in 1908, he observed, I dimly sensed some slight feminine aspect to his manner and movements. Modern critics suggest that modern-day Freudians are influenced by Freud's feminine passive feelings so much that they regard masculine assertiveness and aggression as a neurotic manifestation. You see, that comes right up into now with all this homosexuality, and if men don't operate the way he wants them to operate, then they're screwed up. Heterosexual men are screwed up. They tend to project their own conflicts and values about this into their patients. As a result, much harm may be done to the patient and others in the patient's lives. Well, you know, all this kind of screwed up thinking gets into the movies, gets into the books, gets into every area of life, and goes on and on. Sort of like forget his name, Spock, about the children, and a whole generation miseducated their children. By a curious coincidence, both Freud and Fleiss underwent identical surgical operations within weeks of each other. Removal of a furuncle on the scrotum. Freud viewed the coincidence as a secret biological sympathy. The men had similar personalities, and according to Gross, were intrigued with the metaphysical and magical, the mystical. When Fleiss came up with his theory, which posited a connection between the mucous membranes of the nose and the female genitals, Freud went along with it and even allowed Fleiss to operate on his nose. Fleiss' theory of periodicity was grounded in astrology and numerology. That's as bad as Ronald Reagan and his wife running the government through astrology. Oh, man. Even Hitler was into astrology. Made a couple of really bad errors in military operations because of astrology. One of them was the, when the British were defeated and trying to get back across the channel. One of the reasons they made it was because of Hitler's astrology and dreams that he held the panzers back. Freud's neurotic dysfunctions manifested themselves in unusual behavior patterns and in psychosomatic ailments, particularly those affecting the mouth, the genitals, and the anus. At the age of 7, he walked into his parents' bedroom and deliberately urinated on the floor. He fainted often. He suffered lifelong indigestion, often with constipation in an irritable, spastic colon. He suffered phobias about riding in trains, about death, and about visiting Rome. More often than not, he was chronically depressed and had bad temper. His fear of death obsessed him, and he would spend much time with Fleiss figuring out when he would die, using his friend's numerology theories. There we go. We're not excluded from that either, because David Lane and I used to go round and round because he was into numerology. And he wrote a book or one or maybe two books about numerology. Well, I discount numerology when you start depending on it to tell the future and all that stuff. He often recounted the death of his younger brother Julius, who had died in childhood. He was unable to separate his emotions, as Gross describes, quote, "Hostility was pinned up inside this almost shy, somewhat feminine Jew man, like a caged feline. He was an angry soul which hated even when it loved, a trait which he had passed down to us as ambivalent when it loved, a trait which he has passed, oh, We know that with Freud, intense love and hate were especially apt to go hand in hand, comments Jones. His distorted love-hate emotions first made a victim of Breuer, then Fleiss, then Jung, Adler, Steckel, and anyone else who initially advanced. Then stood in the way. He perpetually read unconscious hostility into his cases, including that of Dora, the Wolf Man, and the Rat Man. He did this even over the reasonable objections of his patients, who said they felt no such hostilities. The Rat Man complained that he could not have wanted his father's death, for he loved him and feared losing him. Freud encountered with one of the convoluted somatic twists that at once made his ideas invincible. The fear of death is actually a wish, he said. Every one of man's fears corresponds to a former unconscious wish, he told his now guilty patient. Max Scher traced Freud's superstitious fear of death to his own harboring of such death wishes, first against others, then against himself. It was aggression turned inward, as analysts say. In terms of wishes, his superstition meant that because he wanted Fleischl, his father, his brother Julius, his sister Anna, and anyone else he hated to die, he would die, his physician suggested. Freud's death wish neurosis became so strong he falsely believed that man had a death instinct. Thanatos, that was normal and universal. Modern Freudians follow in the footsteps of their prophet. Despite Freud's attempts to prevent psychoanalysis becoming the exclusive preserve of Jews, Dr. Gross tells us that these days there is a strong representation of Jewish patients, a tendency possibly related to the large number of Jewish analysts, a tradition begun by Freud and his disciples. In a Maryland study, 40% of the patients were Jewish, 33% were Protestant, 13% Catholic, and 12% without affiliation. An American Psychoanalytic Association study generally confirmed these figures. They report that 45.2% Jewish patients, 43.6% Protestant, and 10% Catholic. The psychoanalytic community is even more geographically clustered than our general psychiatrists. The two major analytic capitals are almost 3,000 miles apart, Manhattan and Los Angeles. Psychoanalysis is so much grounded in the metropolitan Jewish life that Gross reports 11 central states which do not have a single psychoanalyst, one Manhattan office building houses more psychoanalysts than seven states combined. The profession is so dominated by Jews that Yiddish words and Jewish expressions are used as part of the jargon. The American Psychoanalytic Association is known as the Kosher School of Analytic Therapy, we are told. Curing a patient is commonly called bringing him to be a mensch. In the area of payment, modern analysts follow Freud's true and tested method. Freud ingeniously tied the fee to results. If the fee is very low, he warned, the value of the treatment will be denigrated in the patient's eyes. Free treatment is an analytic disaster, he insisted. Without the corrective influence of money, the patient is supposedly deprived of a useful incentive to exert himself to bring the cure to an end. Only in a few areas does the modern analysis so slavishly follow Freud. The bill for a month's analysis, some $1,000 at $50 an hour, is not mailed. It is presented eyeball to psyche to the patient at the end of the month. If the payment is not forthcoming in time, there is an automatic reminder in the next bill. The next step is medicine's most effective collection system. The analyst injects the unpaid bill into the analytic work to find the unconscious reason for the resistance. Hey, man, you got to get up pretty early in the morning to outdo these kikes. Resistance is one of the psychoanalysis' most useful shibboleths. It features in one profession joke about a patient's punctuality. If the patient comes early, he is displaying anxiety. If he comes late, he is offering resistance. If he regularly comes on time, he is compulsive. Whatever a patient does, there is always something wrong with him. How reminiscent this supposedly witty antidote is for Sigmund Freud's attitudes. No matter what his patient said or did, he would immediately project into them his own neurosis. Could it possibly be that the psychoanalytic industry is cast in the same mold? Could it be that the psychiatry amounts to no more than Jews telling the rest of us that we suffer from Jewish neuroses? I love it. Michael, you did it. David McCaldon, you did it. I love this nailing, putting the donkey tail on the donkey. Let me read a little more here on therapy. There can be no doubt that psychotherapy is the boom industry of our age. In 1955, psychiatric clinics treated a modest 233,000 people. By 1977, the figure had risen to 3.9 million. Another 3 million attended private therapists. You begin to wonder how all this homosexuality and all this weird shit came about. Well, you're getting it right now. It's been around for a long time. Yet objective tests have shown that much of the therapy is totally unnecessary. Well, I've always said you can get more therapy from a bartender in a bar than you can from a psychiatrist. Dr. Jerome Frank of the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore suggests that the therapy industry may be self-perpetuating and self-serving. Quote, the greater number of treatment facilities and the more widely they're known, the larger the number of persons seeking their services. Psychotherapy is the only form of treatment which, to some extent, appears to create the illness it treats. Dr. Hans J. Eisenach of the University of London's Institute of Psychiatry compared the success rate of patients who had received therapy and those who had received none. There was little or no difference. Oh, think of all those big shot movie stars and stuff getting therapy and paid tens of thousands. This was in 1952. He followed up with a 1965 study, which so outraged the psychiatric establishment that he was forced to conclude that it was as if we were attempting to statistically test of the efficiency of prayer, unquote. More recent surveys cited in Martin Gross's blasphemous Psychological Society underline Eisenach's early findings. Comparisons between patients receiving therapy and patients receiving placebos or even just staying on the waiting list show no difference whatsoever. Many of the modern therapy gurus started off as orthodox Freudians. Some, like Erich Fromm, started off as Orthodox Jews. Fromm was born in Frankfurt in 1901, descending from a long line of rabbis, and was raised in a strictly Orthodox home. After graduating from Heidelberg University at the age of 26, he apparently severed his ties to dogmatic Judaism and became an agnostic. He studied at the Berlin Psychoanalytic Institute and in 1929 returned to Frankfurt, where he lectured at the local university in social psychology. He also became a member of the famed Frankfurt School, the Frankfurt Institute for Social Research of the far-left Jewish thinkers, which also included Max Hockenheimer, Frederick Pollock, Leo Lowenthal, Herbert Marcuse. I remember Herbert Marcuse was teaching at San Diego State. I believe it was one of the universities in San Diego. when a guy that I met later said that they got a young guy and talked him into taking a shot at Marcuse, trying to assassinate him. And as it turns out, the government plant that was doing the job, was going to help him do the job, drove him to Marcuse's place, apartment, handed him the gun. And the guy took a shot, and he missed Marcuse, but he injured a young student that was studying with Marcuse. And I can't remember the young man's name right now. He was just a misguided right winger. So anyhow, as time went on, I got with some reporters that were trying to uncover all the facts in the case. And meanwhile, the young man was in prison. And the investigative reporter went in and talked to him for a while. And all of a sudden, they built a case and we got him out. His name's right on the tip of my tongue, but I can't recall right now. So I knew all about Marcuse and his operation in San Diego when he was still alive. Also, Franz Neumann and Theodore Adorno. Here, each of them pontificated on the reasons for the rise of Nazism. And Fromm would pirate most of his explanations published as an escape from freedom in 1942 from his colleague Wilhelm Reich's Mass Psychology of Fascism of 1933. Other ideas he lifted from Karl Marx, that other great German Jewish rabbinical descendant. Oh, the guy's name I remember. Mickey Hoover was the guy's name. And you can go back in the books in the library and you can find stuff written about that case of the attempted assassination and also about getting Hoover out of prison. Fromm explained that the psychological foundations of Nazism were due to an ambiguous relationship to authority, characteristic of German lower middle class. The petty bourgeois at once craved authority and rebelled against it. Fromm blatantly ignored the fact that National Socialism was a movement of the proletariat, not of the ruling class or bourgeois. Even the name of the party was the National Socialist German Workers' Party. In a straight case of projection, Fromm was actually attributing Jewish bourgeoisie behavior patterns to the Nazis. As we shall see later on, the Jews are caught up in the continual psychological conflict, craving paternal rabbinical authority while at the same time rebelling against it. The rebelling is often redirected in other areas, of course. With the advent of National Socialist government in Germany, the Frankfurt Institute packed up and moved en bloc, first to Geneva and then to New York in the United States. The Frankfurters ungratefully complained about the authoritarianism which lurked beneath America's democratic facade. Here they all went their separate ways. Fromm revised many of Freud's theories and charged that Freud had omitted a multitude of social and economic factors in developing his psychoanalytic positions. Fromm taught at various U.S. universities before returning to Europe in 1969. In 1973, he began publishing a book of straight projection, The Anatomy of Human Destructiveness, which alleged that Hitler and Himmler suffered from necrophilous personalities, as we have seen in the case of Karl Marx, and as we shall see later in the findings of the brilliant psychohistorian Dr. Howard Stein. On the contrary, it is the Jews who suffer from death fixations. Fromm himself died a few years later in 1980 in Switzerland. Fromm's colleagues, William Reich, who was only half Jewish, found the U.S. to be much more to his liking. He wrote that America was the only country in the world where one could stand up for pursuit of happiness and the rights of the living. He moved more and more to the right and condemned Soviet imperialism, liberal complacency, and trade with the communists. After a couple of years operating a private psychoanalytic practice in Forest Hills, a Jewish suburb of New York. Reich had accumulated enough money to buy an estate near Rangeley, Maine. Here he developed some strange individualistic ideas of his own. Although Reich had actually trained with Freud in Vienna and had worked at the prestigious Berlin Psychoanalytic Institute, he was now moving towards a more esoteric analytic position. He developed the theory of orgon, which was a unique energy in the human body, actually the primordial sexual energy out of which all life springs. More orgon could be found in nature, such as in hurricanes, gravity, and aurora borealis. Only nuclear energy was separate. In fact, the history of the universe was a titanic struggle between orgon and nuclear energy. The study of orgon, known as orgonomy, bridged the gap between science and religion. Reich began to have delusions of grandeur and compared himself to Jesus Christ and Socrates. He started to become paranoid about having his theories hijacked and spoiled by others. Indeed, he did receive some questionable support from the homosexual and drug proponents Allen Ginsberg and William Burroughs in the hopes of heading off pornographic exploitation of his discoveries. Reich revamped his terminology in a remarkable, revealing pronouncement. The word sex abuse and smutted into a horrible nightmare, into rubbing of cool penises within stale vaginas, unquote, was abandoned by Reich altogether, and for sexual intercourse he substituted the genital embrace. Reich eventually developed a therapeutic tool, an orgon accumulator, which was a six-sided phone booth where the patient would sit in order to absorb concentrated orgon radiation. He also developed a cloud buster, which would cause rain to fall. Truly, the age of rainmaking is not confined to the 30s deep south. Eventually, the federal government noticed some of these strange goings-on, and the Food and Drug Administration raided his estate in an incredible series of events. Reich's books were burned, his equipment seized, and he himself was thrown in jail. On 3 November 1957, Reich died of a heart attack at Lewisburg, Pennsylvania Penitentiary, having served 8 months of a 2-year sentence for transporting orgon boxes across state lines. While we cannot but be outraged at the federal government's authoritarian treatment of such a man, we are left with the disturbing perception that all cannot have been well with a man who regarded sex as a horrible nightmare and the rubbing of cold penises within stale vaginas. An equally odd career was led by Fromm's and Reich's Frankfurt colleague, Herbert Marcuse. He collaborated on the Frankfurt Institute's study of authority and family, which was started in Frankfurt but published in Paris in 1936 after Hitler's takeover in Germany. This was yet another Jewish Marxist explanation of the rise of Nazism, due, of course, to German family life. The study would also act as a springboard for Marcuse and Adorno's 1950 diatribe on the psychological underpinnings of the American variants of fascist anti-Semitism and ethnocentrism, the authoritarian personality. However, the most authoritarian, ethnocentric, and punitive families of all, Jewish families, do not figure into these condemnations for some odd reason. After fleeing to the United States, Marcuse miraculously landed a job with the newly formed Office of Strategic Services, the wartime forerunner of the CIA. His Marxist political outlook was to bar to such sensitive intelligence job. In fact, it was almost a qualification, for as we read in OSS by R. Harris Smith, University of California Press, the service was staffed by radical foreign-born Jews from top to the bottom. Many of these Jews would later go on to become lawyers and interpreters at Nuremberg kangaroo trials in occupied Germany. After the war, Marcuse took up various lecturing positions in the U.S. universities. He engaged in debates in the columns of Dissent, the leftist Jewish magazine, with Eric Fromm, who did by this time. Oh, let's see, where am I at here? At this time, by this time, at long last, even mainstream publications like Time were beginning to ask serious questions about Jewish psyche. Dr. Judith Klein's pioneering work in this field reflects our own. She has found the Jewish personality to be full of paradoxes, pride, paranoia, matriarchy, misogyny, arrogance, and inadequacy. We attempt to put these dichotomies into a historical perspective. Anyhow, I screwed up here when I went to the next page. Women, particularly religious women, often made woeful choices, identifying with Sarah for her barrenness, the slaves of Egypt for the mistreatment of the pharaohs, or Eve and Bathsheba for deceitfulness. Low esteem for Jewish women, says Klein, was linked to their feeling of exclusion from Jewish ritual. Another device which Klein introduced midway through the sessions, each participant stands up and says, "I am a Jew," over and over again. It is the most highly charged part of the therapy, and some repeat the phrase until they are shrieking or crying, talking to dead relatives, or even addressing a historical figure like Anne Frank or Moses, says Klein. The emotional release is tremendous. Unlike the Jews in ethnotherapy, the blacks and Italians do not accuse the opposite sex of being unattractive. Among blacks, the main issue seems to be unfaithfulness and fear of abandonment. In black groups, the toll of racism shows up in high anxiety and suppressed rage. Men are not sure how to respond to the newly aggressive black female, says black psychologist Ronald Brown of San Francisco. And women are pushing men for more commitment to the family. Some blacks also fear the entering the middle class is somehow a betrayal of the rest of the community. I think that this is a little disjointed here. Just a minute. Well, the way this magazine or this booklet is laid out, there was a news article in there that I went the wrong way and was reading into that. But we're going to stop for today, and we'll take it up maybe tomorrow or next day or sometime. Very interesting, the research David McCollum did on the Jewish psyche. And for everybody that keeps always asking, how did we get into all this homosexuality and all this deviant behavior? Well, now you know. It's been going on for a long time. Because this stuff is taught in all the schools. They got millions of books on it. These guys were the gurus, Jewish from top to bottom. So as far as I'm concerned, that's what led to the great explosion of homosexuality and also perversion. I'm not saying necessarily homosexuality is perversion, but there's a lot of other perversions that seem to come along with a lot of this stuff. You get what I'm talking about, boys and girls? In other words, you get the Jew thinkers out of your society and you'll have a pretty healthy society. Until you do that, you're going to have a pretty unhealthy society. Well, that's it for today, boys and girls. Getting back in the groove here. I'll be back tomorrow on Wotan's Day. And we'll see what else we can dig up here for you. 14-5 and shut your pie hole and be a good little lone wolf. And remember, I have nothing to say. And don't forget how Obama is screwing the middle class and the working class absolutely to the wall. And they deserve it because they thought they'd expiate all their guilt by putting a nigger in the White House.
The real great adventures of me, Tom Terrific, with Mighty Manfred the Wonder Dog. Terrific, greatest hero ever. Terrific is the a name for me, 'cause I'm so clever. I can be what I wanna be, and if you'd like to see, follow, come follow me. If you see a plane on high, a diesel train go roaring by, a bumblebee or a tree, it's me. When they're a couple, I'm there on the double, from Atlantic to Pacific. They know I'm terrific.
I'm Mighty Manfred, the Wonder Dog, and Tom's ever faithful companion.